crush your enemies.
They drew first blood, not me.
See them driven before you?
Oh, my user.
And they hear the lamentation of their women.
But I pity the fool.
Glitter in the dark near the ten house gate.
Phone home.
They're here.
Oh, real light sleeper, child.
Welcome to Vintage Video, where we're rewatching the 80s so you don't have to. We'll be reviewing every major film released of the 1980s in chronological order, overanalyzing what you've seen and spoiling what you haven't. I'm Patrick O'Reilly.
I'm Jesse Bayless.
And I'm Richard Wells.
And today we're discussing Night Crossing, released February 5th, 1982. It was written by John McGreevy, directed by Delbert Mann, and released by Buena Vista Distribution. On September 15th, 1979, two families, Strelzik and Wetzel, attempted an escape from East Germany into West Germany via hot air balloon. By the 17th, producer Tom Leach met with Disney VP Ron Miller to propose a film adaptation of the story. A few weeks later, the families accepted Disney's offer over various other studio packages, which amounted to $5,000 for an option and $50,000 if the film got made. The working title was The Balloon Movie, then... That was obviously not ever for actual use.
Oh, I think it would have been more memorable.
Yeah. Then they had Wind to the West, and later The Last Flight to Freedom, which was understandably rejected for its resemblance to fellow Disney title Last Flight of Noah's Ark. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Although that could have been like sparking a franchise, yeah, of the sure. Last Flights of.
The production built 7 balloons, 6 were authentic duplicates of the actual balloon used in the escape, and the 7th was purely for camera tests and aerial photography. The budget totaled $10 million. The film hit theaters just 3 years after the actual event. The film starts with Cold War stock footage, and a voice teaches us about East Germany 1961.
Do we know how much the movie made? Because I feel like $10 million on this is a lot.
I would be surprised if it made that back.
Yeah, me too.
3,000 people a day were emigrating from East to West Germany until the East German regime erected a wall along the boundary to keep people in. 17 million people are trapped by the barriers of this wall and guarded by armed soldiers, as well as hidden alarms and unmanned machine guns. It's a very effective barrier, and attempts to escape are almost never successful.
Today, only the very desperate dare to risk a crossing through the border zone. But East Germans continue to try. Some will succeed. No one knows how many will fail. This is the story of one attempt.
So I guess it's interesting because the film came out before
reunification,
right? So people didn't know how long this situation would still be going on.
Yeah, and it's interesting to be seeing the story of people who are still trapped on the other side of it.
Mm-hmm. I actually wish they had gone into that more because I feel like they don't do a very good job of expressing why it's so bad. Like, they're trapped, obviously, mm-hmm. It's a prison, but... They don't really, and there's very little
actively.
Opportunity, yeah. I feel like, but shy of that, they don't really go into what's so horrible about it.
Right.
Yeah, they, I guess we'll get into it, but, because they're in a small village, and they all have trades mm-hmm. that make them invaluable to the village.
And they all get, apparently, unlimited time off. Mm-hmm. You just call out sick constantly. The opening titles play out over a silhouette of barbed wire against the clouds at sunrise. This story opens in Posneck, East Germany, April 4th, 1978.
Immediately, we are treated to a wonderful Jerry Goldsmith score.
Right, of course.
I was just like, as soon as it started, I was like, oh, well, this is it. This is Jerry Goldsmith.
We see Bo Bridges as Gunter Wetzel riding a motorcycle through an East German village. In the foreground, we see a young boy, Lucas Keller, collecting signatures on a clipboard. Lucas's father, Joseph, calls to him and asks why he's not at school. For some reason, probably because it was shot on location, the dialogue here is fully ADR'd and the lips don't even match, so they might even not be speaking English on set.
Well, I'm a little confused as to why we cast an American and an Englishman as our main German characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is an odd choice. I mean, it's Disney, so they're just like, oh, Disney characters speak English. You just have to figure it out.
Were we supposed to just... pretend they were German, like they weren't supposed to be like they were Americans and Englishmen.
I mean, their names are
Gunter
and Gunter Wetzel.
It just felt a little strange.
And I did check; they are not of the Pretzel family.
Is there a Wetzel Pretzel family?
I don't know. Also, the ADR voice and writing are terrible throughout the film. I really can't stand most of the dialogue.
But every time it says Papa,
yeah,
it's like,
it just sounds so forced and fake and dumb.
Mr. Wetzel, Mr. Strelzik.
Lucas.
Why aren't you at school?
Great honor, Papa. They excused Frederick and me to carry out this important mission for the Republic.
Lucas's father, Josef, is a co-worker of John Hurt as Peter Strelzik and Beau Bridges as Gunter Wetzel in a local factory, and Josef is worried about his son's involvement with the political apparatus.
Wouldn't you know they'd honor me? Who else in the class has read everything that Mueller ever wrote?
Lucas's father shushes the boy, and the kid wanders away to collect more signatures. Weirdly, even though he just bragged about having read all the writings of Horst Mueller, the signatures he's collecting are to condemn Mueller as a traitor. Like, the school is making him collect signatures condemning this guy who he believes in to be a traitor.
Yeah, it's a little weird.
It's strange. Misters Keller, Wetzel, and Strelzik all head into a bar together for an after-work drink. They commiserate about being trapped here and how, as family men, they have no chance at escape. Strelzik suggests that they should all be siding with Mueller, who young Lucas is collecting signatures to condemn. After drinks, Peter drives his son Frank and reminds the young boy that he can speak freely alone with his parents, but in public he must toe the government-approved political line. Frank knows all this and promises not to publicly protest. He seems just as annoyed with how the nation is being run, but his father assures him that times change. They swing through the market to collect Frank's mother, Dora Strelzik, played by Jane Alexander. And this is like the only slight bit that we get of how life sucks here. Because the fruit carts in this open square are pretty sparsely stocked, and customers are just starting to fight over what's left here.
But they don't.
They don't, but I feel like they're pointing out that they're on the verge of a collapse. That this woman is like, you know what, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have taken this before you here. You have it.
I know, but I guess...
But you're right, it should have been a fight, and then she got in the car and left.
They are about to make a decision that is putting their lives and their children's lives in jeopardy. I feel like it should be worse than, I tried to grab a fruit, another woman got it first, and then she's like, oh, I'm sorry, you have it.
Yeah.
Like, this is...
You know what, that's unacceptable. I'm going to murder my kids tonight in a hot air balloon fire.
Also, the fact that this movie takes place over the course of almost, what, a year?
A couple of years, yeah.
And so it's like, things don't get worse.
Right.
Then
we're not recognizably worse for us. Doris hops into the car with Peter and Frank, and they head home. At home, Frank's younger brother, Fitzer Valve.
Probably the humidity.
It's all ball bearings now. At home, Frank's younger brother, Fitzer, is watching a movie on television, but Grandma turns it off because it's a West German broadcast and it's forbidden to watch here. Why do I even have this channel if I'm not going to watch here?
You really can't stop television signals because they're
there
just
should be
an antenna.
Guards stopping that. Well, no, turn around signals.
You would just manufacture televisions that can't tune to that channel, I guess.
Maybe.
Well, they don't seem to have enough resources to do much of anything around here, so I don't think they can manufacture new televisions for everyone.
I do like, though, whenever something comes up on Reddit where someone's like, oh man, I didn't realize how old this hairdryer was, and they turn it around and it says made in West Germany. It's like, Jesus. Nearing dark, we see Lucas riding a motorcycle up to the border checkpoint. He explains he's giving his girlfriend Karen a ride home, and a guard reminds him to exit the borderland before 10 p.m. Apparently, her family farm is actually located within the border because the wall ran so close to the farm that it's like some people just live in here and they have to pass through this checkpoint at night. After he drops her off, he stops for a moment, seeming to contemplate escape. We watch him park his bike beside a bulldozer parked off the side of the road, and then we see him emerge hours later in a guard's uniform with bolt cutters to cut chains off the vehicle before hot-wiring it. A pair of guards on a tower spot the approaching bulldozer and wonder what unscheduled work it's here for. They eventually sound the alarms and shine spotlights on it. Lucas raises the bulldozer blade to block their gunfire. When they shatter the windshield, Lucas dives out of it, sending it barreling through the supports of the guard tower, and the whole thing crashes to the ground. His victory is short-lived, though, as another group of guards approach, and Lucas leaps onto the fence to climb to freedom. He's struck immediately by what appears to be automatic machine gun fire. The soldiers find him bleeding on the ground, but alive, and they leave him here to die.
I'm not sure what his plan was. Was his plan always to take down the guard tower?
I think so.
It feels like it.
I would have...
You think he was going to plow through the wall with it?
Until
the windshield broke?
Well, because they mentioned that the ground was mined. What I thought, he was going to plow through the wall and just drag the front of it through the dirt so that it would shield him from any kind of mine explosions.
Yeah, maybe.
Because that's what these modern minesweepers do, is that they have all this stuff in the front and a shield because it just goes through the dirt.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And triggers the mines intentionally.
It's like a tiller almost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's what I assumed he was going to do, because you know you have to he has to know you can't get through the fence.
I mean, he could with the bulldozer.
But that's the thing. He set it up to target the guard tower.
Yeah, and I wonder if that wasn't a last-minute decision because the windshield shattered, and he was like, well, fuck, this isn't working how I wanted it to, but at least I can take out some guards this way.
Yeah, and I feel like this is supposed to be one of those supporting arguments, and I agree. Like, freedom is important, but the only person we see die in this movie is somebody, like, actively trying to cross the border. Like,
right.
I feel
yeah.
like there needed to be more oppression showed within, you know, the community, where it's like people didn't deserve what they were getting. Not that this kid deserved to die, obviously.
Right. But aren't we also seeing the implied death, or at least severe injury, of the guards in this tower that got knocked over and collapsed?
Yeah.
I mean, we don't see them dead on the ground or anything like that, but I think the implication is that he took two guards with him.
Yeah.
I think it would have been interesting to play up some of the where you have neighbors calling the state police on neighbors.
I mean,
because,
we do imply a lot of that.
Yeah, but it would have been good to see it. Like, because they keep worrying about the next door neighbor. It would have been good to see her actually get somebody in trouble.
Yeah, the closest we get is from Strelzik's neighbor, not Wetzel's neighbor, because Strelzik's neighbor, Hans, is the one who's, like, constantly hounding them with questions. The next day, Peter is leaving again for work when he's stopped by a familiar military official, his next-door neighbor, Hans.
Good morning.
Good morning, Oberlieutenant.
Please. Hans is the name, Hans.
Hans asks Peter to confirm that he carpools to the factory, and Peter says he does with Günther and Josef. Hans probes the man about his relationship to Josef and Josef's son Lucas, but cryptically drops his line of questioning there and then walks away. Later, we see Strelzik and Wetzel's families having a picnic together beside a river. Lucas's parents are here, and their concerns over his disappearance cast an ominous shadow over the fun. Lucas's mother Magda cries, and Peter's wife Doris does her best to console the woman. Josef shares with Peter a note from Lucas, which sounds like equal parts goodbye letter and suicide note.
Tired of waiting and hoping. Till we're together again in a better place. Remember, I love you all. We, like the eagles, were born to be free.
And he says he found this, like, in a book on his bed, so it seems like it was specifically written, like, I'm out of here.
I think
Follow
it was
me.
Specifically in a book of the writings of that
right,
guy
the Mueller
they're being
guy.
Asked
yeah.
to condemn. Yeah.
The picnic is suddenly interrupted by a procession of government vehicles. It's Hans again, here to collect the Keller family. Later, Günther and his wife Petra watch their baby sleep and hold each other, somberly recalling the events of the picnic.
People weren't meant to live like this.
We hard cut to Lucas's mother with a blunt update.
Lucas is dead. He tried to cross the border and was shot. Many times. They showed me pictures.
She was released, but they're holding Josef prisoner because they blame Lucas's parents for his actions. That night, Peter confesses to Doris that he has to escape this place. Doris understands but doesn't share his desire to escape. She considers Lucas responsible for what's happened to the Kellers, and Peter is shocked to hear her wildly misplaced blame.
But look at what he's done to that family.
Ultimately, she agrees that they're all to blame because they're all doing nothing to change their situation. She cries, and Peter promises to take action for the sake of their children.
Like Lucas said in his note, I want us all to be together in a better place.
We cut forward to June 20th, 1978. Peter's on a construction site with Günther and drawing plans in the dirt with a board. He thinks he can construct a flying vehicle to escape in, and more specifically, a hot air balloon. I feel like drawing this on the ground is a bad idea, especially as big as you are. Like, this is like... This calls for a napkin and a bar. Like...
Something you can eat.
Something I could see from across the room. Something you could eat, right. Just scarfing up all the dirt. You could have just, like, wiped it with your hand. Shut up! Peter suggests the nature of their jobs allows them to work on this during their scheduled work hours without drawing any unwanted attention from the government. Sometime later, they confess their plans to Petra and Doris, who are more than skeptical.
God, it's so ridiculous. What, 8 of us hanging up there?
You
You have it all worked out?
We cut to the men at a local fabric market buying up as much as they can with Peter's liquidated life savings. The saleswoman is surprised at the oversized order, and they claim it's to stitch tents for a camping club. I'm kind of shocked they didn't break this down into smaller, less suspicious orders.
Yes.
From separate vendors to avoid drawing unwanted attention to the operation. A looky-loo neighbor sees them carrying the fabric inside that night and is weirdly inquisitive and suspicious of the purchase. Like she somehow predicts they might be making a hot air balloon with it. It's like, just looks like a dead body in a yeah, rug. Calm down.
It's a corpse. Yeah. Good night. What's worse is, like, they convince her that it's a rug, but then their kids go, I
want
to see
the rug. Put the rug in my room. It's like, shut up. Who gives a crap about a rug?
Really tied the roof together.
We get a montage of the men constructing the balloon and the burner framework over months. Someone buzzes the door at their office, but they don't buzz with the agreed-upon sequence of buzzes. So they're worried it might be government officials, but it's just Petra, and she buzzed in wrong for literally no reason, just as a goof, I mm-hmm. guess. She says the neighbor woman is getting increasingly suspicious and questions every piece of equipment she sees enter the home. Petra is here delivering hot soup because the woman noticed that Gunter has been home from work several days. This honestly seems pretty sloppy of them.
Yeah.
They should be doing this work after hours. Gunter tells Peter he expects the balloon will be ready by tomorrow. They make plans to test the equipment soon. Gunter's wife Petra is clearly terrified by every aspect of the plan, from being caught and executed to falling to their deaths from a flaming hot air balloon.
Yeah, she keeps listing all these things that could go wrong, and I was just reminded of, I hear those things are awfully loud. It's just like, it's like he keeps trying to comfort her about, like, what if this happens? What if that happens?
Yeah, the ring came off my pudding can. The test goes poorly when they can't capture the heat from their torch in the actual balloon.
Yeah, I was infuriated.
It's like, this is not how you do it.
I know nothing about hot air balloons, but I know that this is not how you fill a hot air balloon.
October 14th, 1978. Yosef is released and Peter spots him at the local pharmacy. Peter is relieved to see his friend free, but Yosef appears zombified by his imprisonment. And when he gets to the register, the writing is almost shamefully on the nose.
Mr. Keller, this is an extremely powerful painkiller.
I hope so.
Keller warns Peter away from their continued friendship, suggesting that he is contagious with something incurable. Keller looks outside to a man in the alley with his arms crossed waiting for him, like some kind of government-assigned handler on whose orders Keller is acting now.
A man is in my condition. The only way he can be a friend is not to be a friend.
Later that day, Peter is visited again by Hans. He's just being creepy and advises Peter not to work so hard. But we never see Yosef again. Like,
yeah.
The implication is that he's going to kill himself like that night.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
And that's why he's not a part of this plan moving forward. But we never say that outright.
It is a Disney movie.
Right.
Of course.
But then why even have this pharmacy scene? We could have left him in government custody and it still would have been sad. We didn't have to be like, oh, he's given up on life. That's why he didn't come with them. Okay, good for him. A second test of the equipment is more successful at inflating the balloon, but still not enough to get it off the ground. In the middle of the night, Petra awakes screaming from a nightmare and demands to see her children immediately. By the time she gets back to bed, she's made up her mind that she and Gunter will not be a part of the escape with the Strelzigs. She's confident the plan is a death trap and she won't have any part of it. After a bit of back and forth, Gunter agrees to step away from the plan and tell Peter tomorrow. Gunter is understandably disappointed, but Peter assures him that their lives will improve here. There have been some promising changes and Petra's getting a good position at a new job. Peter says he has to keep everything secret going forward to protect Gunter from later interrogations. Peter sits Doris down to confirm she approves of the plan, and we cut forward to April 23rd, 1979. This is like 6 months we just jumped.
Mm-hmm.
Frank is now in on the secret and helps Peter iron out the inflation issues. They take everything out to the clearing and it's going better until they accidentally set fire to the fabric. Luckily, they're able to put it out quickly, but it's a somber reminder of the volatility of this plan.
My brain was not catching up to what you were saying and I'm like, inflation issues? I didn't think there was any money problems in this.
Fabric. Every day it's more. We should have bought it all at once. As suspiciously as possible. Many tests later, they get the balloon filled and lifted off the ground. They didn't bring enough gas for the journey tonight, but tomorrow they escape. July 3rd, 1979. The Strelzigs meet with Doris's mother for their last day in the country and carefully avoid discussing any future plans. She seems to sense something is amiss and that this is a goodbye.
It was weird that it's July, because tonight we escape. It was like, Well, tonight was April 23rd.
Yeah.
what happened?
Long time later. The grandmother corners Doris in another room to confirm her suspicions. She gets all the proof she needs from a sobbing hug that this is a goodbye. That night, Peter has to drag Doris from the home as she does some panicked last-minute cleaning.
I'd really like the house clean before they tear it down.
What is that from?
The Goonies, Mary Ellen Trainer.
Do you remember the last time we saw a husband and son ready to leave but slowed down when the mother returned to the house for needless chores?
I can't recall anything.
She just wanted to tell Mrs. Allardyce that they were leaving.
Is that The Burning? Burnt Offerings.
Burnt Offerings.
I knew it was burning.
It's something. A burnt something.
In a clearing in the woods, they get the balloon filled and wake their younger son, Peter Jr., just in time to take off. He alone had been left out of the plan until now, and they are soon on their way. At a watchtower along the borderlands, a guard spots the glowing balloon on the horizon and climbs down a ladder to report it. When the first gas tank runs out, they have trouble starting the second because of the moisture in the air. Without a solid flame, the balloon begins a premature descent.
The gas is flowing, Papa, but the pressure's way down.
We keep seeing them flick a lighter to keep it lit, and I was worried this would suddenly blow up in their faces. Like, I'm pumping a bunch of gas, but it's not lit. Here, give me that lighter. The guard who phoned in the balloon now reports having lost sight of it, and the balloon eventually touches down.
I think it'd be really funny if they got caught because they, you know, found them after the fact and they were missing all of their eyebrows.
Yeah. Are you guys the ones that fell out of that flaming balloon earlier?
No.
Not us. We look like this year round. This is a thing. It's a big trend.
As they turn to walk away, just the backs are just like smoldering.
Yeah. Cartoons with their butts hanging out of their burnt pants. Once they've hopped out of the basket, the balloon disappears back into the sky, but there's nothing they can do to stop it. After a moment, they deduce that not only aren't they in the West, but they've landed in the border zone and they're surrounded by fencing and guards. They must somehow hike back to their car and get home before anyone else senses what they've done. In the pre-dawn light, they step carefully through the wilderness over trip lines back to safety. The guards spot the downed balloon and perforate it with gunfire. I suspected here that it would be a short leap to identifying the fabric and connecting it to a suspicious bulk order, and then Peter specifically.
I don't think the guards are shooting it. I think it's touching the fence.
Oh, okay. Is that what happened?
It's triggering the automatic machine guns.
Is that how those work? Because I was like, Because
as soon as he grabs the fence, it shoots him.
So I think
I was really confused. I'm like, how are these guns so advanced in 79 or whatever that they could just shoot whatever is... They're kind of just spraying bullets around.
Right, but I think how it works is I think the fence is electrified, and when it senses a short, it triggers...
It aims for the short.
I think they're just aimed along the fence line.
Oh, okay.
But when it senses a short... a sudden loss of flow, that just it starts activating machine guns.
It's weird to me that this balloon would even trigger that, unless it's like maybe it's wet enough.
Mm.
When the Strelzics reach the checkpoint, they simply wander through arm in arm, and none of the guards ask any questions. It's weird that this isn't a bigger problem for them to get out of the borderland.
Well, I mean, there's other people walking around that area.
Yeah.
Their guards are concerned about the people getting on the bus to
go
exit.
Out. Yeah. And at this point, they don't know that there are people that would have been trapped in the borderlands overnight. So.
And walking back into East Germany, they're like, yeah, good. Get in there.
Go deeper.
It's like how they never ask me any questions when I'm breaking into prison. They're like, in? Yeah, go for it. Walking along a road back to their car, they see a passing tow truck and worry that their car has been spotted. The border patrolmen phone in Major Kerner to lead a manhunt within the borderland because they suspect the attempted escapees are still trapped inside. Major Kerner arrives by helicopter, played by Gunter Meisner, aka Slugworth. After hours more walking, the Strelzics find their car and return home. The guards inspecting the balloons are impressed with its design, and again, I assume this would cast the most suspicion on Peter, the town engineer. Just as they get home, Doris realizes she's dropped her heart meds in the crash. Peter isn't worried about it, and they start making plans to call out sick to work in school when the phone rings.
Yeah, good old 70s when we didn't apparently put labels on medicine as to who it belonged to.
Just do a quick sniff test. That's all it takes. What kind of medicine is this? It's either arsenic or aspirin. Take it, and I'll tell you. Peter answers the phone, and it's Doris's mother, relieved to hear that they're home and alive. Later in the day, Peter wanders around the house contemplating his failure. Doris assures him it'll be okay, but he's inconsolable until Frank and Peter Jr. appear. They clearly have their sights set on another attempt. To kick off this reattempt, Frank has produced for the entire family damning evidence of their attempted escape to wear on the next one, patches with their job titles, and an illustration of the balloon that the border guards are currently investigating. Things they don't want in their house, mm-hmm. or in their possession, or in the car on the way to their next escape.
I've made us some back patches. Commander? Co-pilot? Navigator? Steward?
Peter is moved by the gesture and agrees to start from scratch. A week later, he rings at the doorbell of the Wetzels to beg Gunther once again to join him and his family in the escape. In an office in East Berlin, they are investigating all the tools found in the crashed balloon. The families are running out of time for a second attempt. Major Kerner demands an alert from any fabric store who receives another bulk order of this magnitude.
And you'll think they'll make another attempt?
They will.
Back at the Wetzel house, Gunther asks if he started construction on a second attempt.
Waiting to see how big I should make it.
Better make it for 8.
You guys are getting fat. That night, Gunther breaks it to Petra that he has agreed to join his friends on a second attempt. She's still resistant to the idea until Gunther reassures her with his absolute confidence.
Their first balloon crashed, but this time...
Yeah. What are the chances that happens again?
All your fears came true, but...
The likelihood of him crashing 2 hot air balloons in a row, though? How often does that happen?
It's statistically still the safest way to travel.
Yeah. Peter and Gunther get home from the fabric shop to learn that their attempt has made the papers. We see the guards interrogating the fabric saleswoman who sold them the first batch. She describes the men for Major Kerner and agrees to identify them from a photograph if they have one. Peter is asked by another salesman why he needs so much fabric, and when the man disappears into his office to make a phone call, Peter realizes it's time to go. He exits the store without making a purchase. Major Kerner keeps adding more guards to the manhunt until they find Doris's missing heart meds. It's incredible that they found this tiny little pill bottle somewhere in the field. Yeah.
And again, it's been
weeks.
It's been a long time.
The pharmacist who prescribed the medicine is located and demanded to cough up an address immediately. He flips through his patient catalog and hands over the addresses of everyone with the same prescription, one at a time. Unfortunately for Major Kerner, the skies are clear tonight, and it's ideal timing for a reattempt. The pharmacist's last card is for Doris Strelzik, and their neighbor Hans realizes it must be the Strelziks, because he's like, they have a wagon, the guy works too much, his neighbors are always saying that he's sewing fabric together into large balloons. Everyone races to action. When they get to the Strelzik house, nobody's home, and it occurs to Hans that Gunther Wetzel, Peter's assistant, might be the younger man described by the fabric saleswoman. They change course to the Wetzel home, but the last of the escapees has just left the property before they get there. Most of the family rides in a car with the trailer to the launch site, but the last couple ride on a motorbike, which breaks down on the way, and they have to walk some of the distance until it just spontaneously whirs back to life.
Well, they took it to a hill because they couldn't get the starter to work. Yeah.
They get the balloon inflated and load both families into the basket. It bounces once on its way up, and as it tips, the balloon fabric catches on fire again, but Gunther is quick to douse the flames with a handheld extinguisher. Halfway through the trip, the balloon finds itself in a net of searchlights from the border guards. They're officially spotted.
Major Kerner, they've been spotted.
Let's go. Quick, we're moving out.
Peter and Gunther sense a blockage in the gas line, and they aren't achieving the predicted elevation, so again they expect to land short of their destination. Major Kerner approaches the balloon by helicopter, so they shut off the flames to disappear in the night sky. The balloon starts sinking, and eventually they have to relight the flames. The next time the flames go out, Peter informs them that the gas is fully spent. They don't suspect they can stay in the air long enough, and for basically the rest of this flight, I was just screaming at the screen for them to throw the spent tanks overboard.
Yes, right?
Oh my God. It's my big note. Drop the fucking tanks.
Yes.
What are you doing?
Yes.
And now, then a couple nights later, I could hear Jessie shouting the same thing at the TV while she watched it.
Why? Okay. Now, the only thing I could come up with is that they think that they might land somewhere that would give their positioning away.
Well, what I told you was that I thought they were worried that they couldn't replace these tanks if they needed to do a third attempt.
But they did.
It's like they did.
They replaced them the first attempt.
Yeah. There's no reason in the world that you would sacrifice this attempt for the next attempt.
The only thing that I could think of was that, you know, if it dropped in where there are soldiers or whatever, they would be like, okay, we have a trail of breadcrumbs to lead to wherever they landed.
Yeah.
I just wrote it twice, once in all caps, drop the funky tank.
Yeah.
But if it made the difference of crossing the border because you were light enough to go another few hundred feet,
Yeah, those tanks got to weigh easily 70 pounds each.
Yeah.
I would have loved it if...
And then
if
you got all the tanks out and you drop one kid at a time.
Yeah. No, I would have loved it if it's just like they realize they're not going to make it or they're coming up on these power lines as the balloon is starting to descend and they're worried they're going to clip the power lines. And Gunter's just like, I'm sorry, Petra, I got to do it. And she's like, I love you. And then he just pushes her out of the basket. And the balloon just picks up and flies off.
And then
Frank's just like, hey, how much do you think these gas tanks weigh? And it's like, oh, shit.
Or even better, like he pushes her out, but there's like, oh, we already landed.
Yeah.
Oh. And the wife's just staring at him.
And she's just like hanging in the power lines, just smoking. Like that dog from Neighbors.
Oh, I was going to say Brad Pitt in Deadpool 2.
For one frame. They don't throw the tanks overboard, though. And 28 minutes into their escape attempt, the actual length of the real escape, their trip has ended. The balloon touches down in a field, and the families scurry into the woods to hide, while Peter and Gunter walk to the nearest structure to investigate where they've landed. The search is interrupted by the arrival of a police car with lights flashing. They order Peter and Gunter out of the shadows with a megaphone. With nothing left to lose, they ask the fateful question.
Are we in the West?
Of course, you are.
The men hug to celebrate, and Gunter fires a flare to notify their families in hiding that it's safe to come out. I was more worried of two other possibilities.
Yeah, well, I feel like that's a dick thing to say, like from the cop's point of view, because... Yeah.
To say, of course you are,
because you're clearly near the border.
Right, right, right.
And if they're asking, they are clearly escapees. So, don't say, of course.
Yeah. But I was more worried of two other possibilities, that these might be East German police who are in on the manhunt and lying to them on purpose, or that they might mistake Gunter's incendiary device for a weapon and just shoot him dead.
Yeah.
Because he just whips out this flare and cracks it off into the sky.
I'm like, this is to alert the reinforcements to arrive. Yeah. We're taking this country.
I fully expected them to just open fire on the man. His family gets there and they're like, okay, good news, bad news. Your husband died in the West. But it's all happy from here. The family see the sign. They run from the woods to celebrate, and everybody's happy. They just hug and scream in a field, and it's all good. A closing epilogue tells us the Strelzik and Wetzel families now live in West Germany. Peter owns an electrical supply store. Gunter has realized his dream of becoming an auto mechanic, and the children are free to reach for the sky without the help of a balloon. But they had the help of a balloon.
Mm-hmm.
So with the help of a balloon. That's it. And that's it. That's Night Crossing. It probably seemed like a great idea for a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's really not enough here. Like, I get there's a historical context to appreciate. There's this manhunt is so fabricated and uninteresting.
Well, that's why I really think they needed to focus on how bad the living circumstances were, because I think that's the more interesting part of the story, is to try to get through your day-to-day life while achieving this ridiculous thing.
Also, I think I would have appreciated something like the pharmacist trying to throw out Doris's card because he didn't want to turn in fellow East Germans, and then they catch him doing it. And then...
But how does he know? Because there was a dozen people that had that.
Because maybe he knows.
He just knows.
He knows that...
You're balloon kind of people.
Yeah, but he's also... he's like, he's their doctor. He knows them. He knows them as people. And maybe he got to a situation where he's like, oh, shit, you know what? It definitely is Peter Strelzik, and I can't tell these people that Doris takes this medication. So I'm just going to toss this card, and then someone catches him doing it, or Hans catches him doing it, and is like, oh, shit.
I think we needed more close calls.
I was kind of annoyed that the motorcycle pulled away from the house, and then the cops and then the guards pulled up, because it's like, have this be a chase the whole way to the balloon.
Yep.
There's no reason to completely head this off and be like, there's literally no chance of them
getting
caught
from here. Maybe they were just trying to be, you know, authentic to the real story.
That is the case.
And it just, it's an amazing feat, but it's not, there's just not enough story there to make a 2-hour movie.
Yeah. And they're clearly taking some liberty with the story because it didn't unfold exactly this way. So just take it a few steps further and make it a film. Because
mm-hmm.
this isn't a film. Especially the ending is super anticlimactic. It's like, our balloon slowly touches down. It's like, are we safe? Yeah, we're safe.
Yeah.
Hooray, credits. It's like, what? That's it?
There's even a scene when they're driving to the balloon site that the call has gone out that they're driving a car pulling a trailer.
Right.
And there's a bunch of cops who have people pulled over. And they just casually drive this car with a trailer.
Just blast past it.
Just like, they just drive right by it and nothing happens.
Yeah.
It's like, good call, Petra, selling 15 trailers to our neighbors.
Yeah, exactly.
Yesterday, in case they found out we had a trailer from our neighbor.
Yeah, we needed some like good misdirection. That would have been great.
Yeah.
You know, like have people building like bonfires all throughout the woods to lead the police to other locations.
Yeah. But there's not much here.
Nah, that's it.
I think it's typical Disney fare of the time where it was just like, an adventure happened. It's a true story. You know, let's tell it. I think it should have been German speakers. I think it probably should have been produced in West Germany. Like, this film should have just been a West German film and not an American movie at all. But it's fine. Thumbs down for me, for sure. This is not worth checking out.
Well, I feel like I can't give it a thumbs down because there's, although it's not interesting, I don't think that it's bad.
In terms of the production value, the border looks great. Mm-hmm. I think it's an impressive construction, and that's probably where all of the money went. That and the balloons.
Well, the balloons, yeah. But I just, like, that $10 million seems like a lot to spend on this movie.
But I also don't get much out of the performance. I feel like Petra and Peter are the only two people that I actually care about. Because Peter's wife is way too muted in her performance the whole time. Like, she does break a couple times. But Petra, I feel like they named her Petra because she's petrified the whole time. Like, she's sure that they're all going to die. And she seems like a woman who does not want to take her kids on this journey. That makes the most sense to me. Her reaction makes the most sense to me of anybody here. And I don't really think there's much to the Gunter character or even the Gunter Meisner, the guard that gets called in, the colonel. Is it colonel? No, major. The major that gets called in. I feel like, I think the first time they said it, I thought they just spelt colonel wrong in the subtitles because his name's Major Kerner or something like
that.
But yeah, I feel like there's not enough to the performances here. I think Hurt's trying. I think John Hurt is really trying.
They were fine. I mean, I think everyone was fine. There wasn't enough interesting things happening for them to play off of.
Right.
This was a TV movie.
Yeah. I mean, all Disney live action was at the time.
Yeah.
You don't spend $10 million on a TV
movie. No, but it felt like it. Every performance, you know, as good as some things looked, it just felt like a TV movie through and through.
Would you say the same thing about Amy, that it felt like a TV movie in terms of the pacing and the structure? Because that had to be cheaper, and I feel like that felt theatrical to me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I just think, but it doesn't surprise me as a choice for Disney that they picked this story.
You mentioned Last Flight of Noah's Ark, and that was much better than this.
Yes, I agree.
You know, that had a lot more interesting moments. It had more,
but it's also a melding of different stories too, because it starts as like it's the Flight of the Phoenix story, but it's also mixing in the Heru story of the guy who didn't know that the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a lot more interesting stuff to that, and I feel like if they'd have taken a few more liberties, they could have actually made this, you know, a nail-biting adventure film. That's what I would recommend that anyone attempting to do a remake to exaggerate the story a little bit, because it's not super interesting as it actually historically happened.
I agree.
But I do think the balloons look really cool, especially if that's what they actually looked like. Like, that's incredible that they were able to make such
multicolored.
Like, but not even just that, but the fact that, and I like the fact that the first one is a single color because they bought all the fabric at once, and the second one is
a blend of different colors because it's like they had to spread it out a lot more the second time. But I just think it's interesting that they were able to sort of reverse engineer from memory a hot air balloon, because they didn't have like instructions to just go by on how to make a hot air balloon. They had to figure it out by fucking it up over and over.
Yeah, and I feel like that even that would have made some more interesting moments, because I know that they theoretically talk about having to redesign like the burner multiple times. And
how they're funneling the gas in.
And the guard even comments on how ingenious the version that they ended up with was. But I'm like, why aren't we getting more of like their genius in this in this movie?
But also the way I picture it, and I don't know if this is how they work, but if you asked me to design a hot air balloon from memory, I would start with the basket. I wouldn't even know how to make the basket, but I know that you have the basket at the bottom, and I would think there would be rigid posts to a ring that holds the balloon open above the flame.
Yeah.
And that you're not just supposed to hold it open and just kind of waft the hot air
in. Multiple times these balloons are catching on fire.
Yeah. It's like that's always a risk with a hot air balloon anyway, but it just seemed like so impractical the way that they thought they were supposed to light it.
Mm-hmm.
It was like watching someone just try and catch helium by throwing a balloon at an open tank. And it's like, what are you doing? No.
Yeah.
Also, we had that like moment of tension where like there's a tear in the balloon. But it's like, okay.
Was that just to blame for the quick descent? I know they talked about the gas too. But yeah, I do remember that shot from overhead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, okay. So Is this bad?
Yeah, because like, there's usually a hole at the top of the thing.
Yeah, anyway. Exactly. But you know, they was like a like the they were it tried to make it seem like they were in imminent danger.
Right.
But it.
I mean, I guess you have to in this kind of story.
Yeah.
What are we thinking? Letterboxed on this? Oh, sorry. Did we get thumbs from everybody?
It's a thumbs down from me.
Okay. And what are we thinking? Letterboxed.
All right. I have mine in 11th out of 13. It's below Island of Blood and above The Seduction.
I have mine in eighth place.
Eighth us. What the hell? Start over.
No, you're leaving all that in. It puts it below The Aftermath, but above Butterfly.
I have it in 13th, so it's right under Madman. There's not enough here. And the second Lucas started talking at the beginning of the movie, I was like, oof, I can't believe this is even on our schedule. Our director here was Delbert Mann. He previously directed Marty, which was his feature film debut, and he took home an Oscar for directing. He also directs That Touch of Mink and the TV movie Heidi. The writer here was John McGreevy. He has a lot of series and TV movie writing. The only other feature credit was for Hello Down There in 1969.
Boy, did I call it or what?
Yep, lots of TV movies. The music here, calling it again, Jerry Goldsmith. He is the composer of In Like Flint, The Swarm, Star Trek The Motion Picture, Magic, Alien. For Joe Dante, he scored Gremlins 1 and 2, Explorers, Innerspace, Matinee, and The Burbs. Later, he scores Secret of Nim and Ghost in the Darkness. So far, we've discussed his work on The Ballad of Cable Hogue, Escape from the Planet of the Apes, Cabo Blanco, Omen 3, Outland, Raggedy Man, Boys from Brazil, Coma, and Papillon. The cinematographer was Tony Eamy. We've previously seen his work for North Sea Hijack and The Sea Wolves, and after this he lights Enemy Mine. The editor was Gordon D. Brenner. He previously cut Pete's Dragon and The Apple Dumpling Gang Rides Again for Disney. We've seen his work so far cutting further Disney titles, Herbie Goes Bananas, Last Flight of Noah's Ark, and Condor Man. John Hurt played Peter Strelzik. He made early appearances in A Man for All Seasons, Midnight Express, and Watership Down. He voiced Aragorn in Bakshi's Lord of the Rings. He's Kane in Alien, and we've seen him now in The Elephant Man, Heaven's Gate, and as Jesus in History of the World Part 1. He's back later this season in Partners, and later, 1984. He plays a version of himself in Mel Brooks' Spaceballs. He's in King Ralph, Dead Man. He's Ollivander in the Harry Potter universe, Broom in Hellboy, and Professor Ox in Crystal Skull. While he was in the Disney offices working on this film, he was dragged into a recording booth to lend his voice to their upcoming animated feature, The Black Cauldron. Jane Alexander played Doris Strelzik.
You didn't mention the storytellers.
Oh, yeah, the storytellers.
I love that. Well, because whenever he speaks, that is the first thing that comes to mind. Because
is that a Jim Henson property?
It is Jim Henson, yeah. But he's like the narrator, storyteller guy. He's the main dude that tells all the stories.
Have we shown the kids that at all? You have the DVD, right?
I tried to get them to watch one or two episodes, but I don't know.
Okay.
They just, kids are different these days.
For some reason, I always go back to his unannounced appearance on SNL for Steve Buscemi
as the March Hare.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's like, is that John Hurt?
Jane Alexander played Doris Trelzik. She previously appeared in smaller roles for All the President's Men and Kramer vs. Kramer. We've seen her now in Brubaker, and later she appears in Glory, The Cider House Rules, and The Ring. Doug McKeon played Frank Strelzik. He's Billy Ray, the kid from On Golden Pond last season. He's made a lot of single episode appearances on series like House, Ray Donovan, Masters of Sex, Animal Kingdom, and Shameless. Bo Bridges played Gunter Wetzel. He is the son of Lloyd, brother of Jeff, and father of Dylan. You guys know Dylan? Me and Richard know Dylan. We went to school with him. Before this, he was in 2 Minute Warning, Greased Lightning, and Norma Ray. We saw him last in Honky Tonk Freeway. After this, he was in The Fabulous Baker Boys, The Wizard, Jerry Maguire, Rocket Man, and Max Payne. More recently, he was Vice President and eventual President Ralph Warner on Homeland.
I forgot I worked on two different Bridges movies.
Was it your first credit was Max Payne, right?
Yeah, my first credit was Max Payne, and then I did Tron.
Yeah, so you have credits alongside both brothers. Glynis O'Connor played Petra Wetzel. We've seen her now as Ramona in Those Lips, Those Eyes. I think that was like the major love interest of that film. She's back after this in Johnny Dangerously, and more recently she appeared in 6 episodes of the recent 3 Days of the Condor reboot series, shortened to just Condor. Ian Bannon played Joseph Keller, or Joseph Keller. He previously appeared in the OG Flight of the Phoenix and as Colonel Buckner in the OG Inglourious Basterds. We saw him last as Inspector Godleyman in Eye of the Needle, and before that as John Keller in The Watcher in the Woods. We'll see him next in Gandhi, and later Gorky Park, Ghost Dad, Braveheart, and Waking Ned Devine. Klaus Lowitch played Schmolk. Schmolk. He's back this season as General Vladmirov in Firefox. Gunter Meisner played Major Kerner. We've seen him now in Boys from Brazil, Just a Gigolo, and a minisode review of American Success Company, but I'll always think first of Slugworth from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, which we covered with a Patreon review. He also later plays Hitler for Dan Curtis's Winds of War miniseries. Sky DeMont played Ziegler. He also appeared in Boys from Brazil and more recently as Sandor Zavost in Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut. Jan Nicholas played Lieutenant Feller. We saw him last as a Gestapo captain in The Formula. Kay Walsh played Doris's mother. She was Nancy in David Lean's 1948 Oliver Twist opposite Alec Guinness's Fagin. She was Mrs. Fezziwig in the 1970 Scrooge with Albert Finney in the title role, and this was her final feature film appearance. James W. Gavin played Pilot. We've seen him exclusively as helicopter pilots in When Time Ran Out, The Nude Bomb, and Raise the Titanic, and his IMDb credits are a lot more of that, but he has never flown a helicopter. No, that's not true. He's a professional helicopter pilot. I think that's everything for this one. If you have any thoughts you'd like to share, you can find all our socials at linktree.com/vintagevideopod. If you enjoy what we're doing, consider giving us a review on iTunes. I don't believe it helps our visibility, but it's good for morale. And if you really like the show, maybe you should join our Patreon campaign at patreon.com/vintagevideopodcast to access all of our monthly 70s reviews and a hand in choosing next month's film. Patrons are currently choosing between the following titles: Caged Heat, The Conversation, Foxy Brown, The Golden Voyage of Sinbad, It's Alive, and Truck Turner for a 50th anniversary review next month. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time when we'll be discussing Personal Best, which IMDb describes like so: the intertwined lives and loves of 3 highly ranked athletes striving for the national team. Chris bounces between the beds of male coach Terry and her female friend, competitor, and role model Tori. We leave you now with a trailer for Personal Best.
How did it feel going to the games, winning 2 gold medals? Would you lie to me and tell me it was worth it if it wasn't?
What about you? Gonna go to Moscow next summer?
I want to know exactly what's wrong.
Ow!
Look around you. Look at everybody. Now imagine how many bodies you all buried to get here. Games. Javelin and the discus that shot their weapons. Don't kid yourself. You're here to kill anybody that gets in your way, and all the rest is bull.
I could have been a man's coach.
You actually think that Chuck Noll has to worry that Franco Harris is going to cry because Terry Bradshaw won't talk to him?
Jack Lambert can't play because Mel Blunt hurt his feelings.
Glenn Swan is pregnant.
Rocky Blyer forgot his Tampax.
But you're not going. But a fool believes.
scares you more? Getting beat by Tori Skinner or beating